A lot of reports
the
out there.
The tax man. Are you filing on time, Romy?
Finally. I've already got my return, and for some reason, I always owe the state, and I always get a federal, and I readjust it, and it's a small return, which I'm fine with. I'd rather not give them the money and wait for them to give me back what I've already earned.
Yeah.
So it was a small one, but yeah, I've already gotten that, but yeah, that's a new trend for me. Last year, I did 5 years of taxes, or six, maybe, I can't remember.
And Mr. Reese, are you in? You done? You got all your... Oh, Mr. Reese. Well, you got till Tuesday.
I know what I'll be doing Monday.
Know what you'll be doing Monday on your day off. All right.
So the question on the inflation.
We need to start a revolution. I think that's what we decided at the end of the last hour. The tax code started in the 1860s. It was what? 4% for $800?
3%.
3% for everybody that made over $800 a week?
A year.
And so, Romy, you got some phone calls helping us out here.
Well, Clay didn't hear it, and I texted him, what would it be worth? And he did exactly what Dr. Dean said. He calculated 155 years on 3%.
Okay.
Which today would be equivalent to $78,137.55. Now, there are some other resources online that all come in lower, stating that the average rate between then and now is more like 2.15.
Okay.
And in that case...
And 1% makes a big difference over 120 years. Go ahead. What's the number?
22,000. I mean, that's a $50,000 difference right there.
Yeah.
And that 1%.
So. Yeah, 1% over a long time makes a big difference. Okay, so everybody making something between $25,000 and $80,000 would be charged 3%.
Yeah.
And there were only 7,000 returns filed that first year?
No. In 1917, there were about 700,000 returns filed.
Okay.
788,000 returns, but then it went up to... some 20 million or so in 1920.
And Bernie Sanders was talking about the tax rate under the Eisenhower administration, which did approach 90% for the very, very wealthy people.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very progressive plan. Ronald came in and reset everything. Mm-hmm. Is my memory right?
Yes.
Okay, kind of reset it, brought back or reestablished a reasonable capital gains tax, and then dropped the rate on ordinary income. And then it kind of started creeping back up again, and I think we need another revolution. I mean, if you read history, which you've read some,
a little bit,
you know, it's my position that America was born on the premise of getting out of excessive taxation,
excessive and unreasonable taxation. Yes.
Yeah.
Are we there again?
I guess that's the argument we would have to have.
Well,
when the Senate and the representatives in Washington, D.C. can vote themselves platinum health care, lifetime salaries, pensions beyond anyone's wildest dreams, we had a revolution to beat the bondage of royalty. We're right back in that bondage right now. And I hope every one of those representatives and senators that are home on Easter break that had a hard time at their town council meetings over the last few days are tuned in to Rosie on the House this morning with Dr. David Dean of Grand Canyon University.
The thing with the taxation without representation, part of it is that our colonists were here and the people were making decisions all the way in England and they weren't really being represented. But part of what England was doing was clamping down on taxes that had been on the books for 10 or 15 years. But because of the wars that were going on, the colonial wars and things that they were fighting, were kind of lax. The wars with France and whatnot, they weren't really paying attention to what the colonists were doing. So the colonists weren't being really good about collecting those customs taxes, collecting those tariffs that they needed to do, reporting everything to the government. And so when the government clamps down under the Townsend Acts and under the Stamp Act and whatnot, when they clamp down on everybody, then everybody goes kind of crazy. Wait a minute. This is not American. This is not what we were doing. And so it led to some tensions, which is why the British, leaving a bunch of troops here after that war, they stationed them in Boston and around, and that created some tensions because you've got soldiers hanging around and got civilians hanging around, and eventually it leads to some conflict.
It does. And you got tea sitting on boats in harbor.
Right, and when the Boston Tea Party, when we threw all that tea overboard because we didn't want to pay the tariffs on those, the government in England closed the port of Boston, and that meant that there was nothing could come and go, and all those people that lived in Boston, their revenues went down, their incomes and livelihoods went down, and that was a kind of a hardship. And so, again, they have soldiers kind of around, and before things got too out of hand, they decided, you know, maybe we ought to round up some of these arsenals of weapons that we've stationed out on kind of the frontier and whatnot. And so General Gates comes up with a plan to maybe send a few guys out to a little place called Lexington.
Yeah.
And Concord, and go pick up some of those weapons that
they're actually heading out there to pick up munitions that they have stockpiled.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, is it that? And it's Horatio. Is that the way you pronounce his first name?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now
he should have changed his name.
Now, what's interesting is that, you know, we always hear about the midnight ride of Paul Revere.
Sure.
The British are coming, the British are coming. Well, he would have never said that.
Two if by land, one if by sea.
But he would have never said the British are coming because everybody was British at the time.
Taxes are coming. Taxes are coming.
But he did. He and several other writers did go out and alert the kind of the countryside that troops were moving from Boston out towards Lexington, and that maybe the militia should come out and kind of check out what was kind of going on. Remember, those stockpiles were out there for the militia, for the frontier, so to speak, to protect themselves. And so the Minutemen or the militiamen,
yes,
you know, are get the signal, you know, come out and gather. And here comes several regiments of British troops. And when they arrived at Lexington, they were met with, you know, about 70 or so patriots, you could call them, or Minutemen. Now, not all of them were armed. Some were dispatched to the tavern to go get some weapons and whatnot. And the intention wasn't necessarily a confrontation, but just to see what was kind of up, so to speak. And then the two sides, the Americans, the Patriots under Parker, John Parker was his name, kind of gathered everybody and said, if you don't have a weapon, go over there and get one. Everybody else, stay with me. Okay, here they're coming. Maybe we should disperse a little bit so we're not posing such a threat. In the meantime, the Commander Pitcairn comes up with his British regulars and tells them, hey, you rebels, go ahead and disperse, go home, there's nothing to see here. And in that confusion, somebody fired a shot.
Heard round the world.
Now, does anybody know how many other writers there were other than Paul Revere, and why Paul Revere is the one that's remembered?
Well, there are two other writers, but the reason why Paul Revere is remembered more because he was kind of notable, and he was actually captured along the way. One guy fell off of his horse and had to walk back to Lexington, and the other guy went a little different direction. And so Paul Revere gets remembered because he was a little bit more notorious as a founding father, so to speak. He was a fairly prominent business person in Boston, and so people knew who he was.
Have we ever been able to determine which side fired that first shot heard around the world?
I have an affidavit here that says that the British soldiers shot first. There are affidavits on the other side that said there was some confusion and maybe multiple shots from both sides. One affidavit said that a patriot hiding out kind of behind a wall in the confusion and in the dispersion of
the
troops.
On the grassy knoll?
Kind of let a shot go out, and then that started a flurry of fire. Of course, at the end of the day, we have eight Minutemen killed, 10 wounded, and one British soldier killed. And that was at the end of the Lexington engagement. But the day wasn't over for the British.
Yeah, so what does happen? So the shots are fired. It's apparently a fairly short encounter. They break apart. And what does happen? What time of day was this?
Well, this was early in the morning. So they arrive at the Lexington Green just around sunup.
Okay.
And so there's some light foot soldiers and then some grenadiers kind of behind them. The light foot soldiers kind of dispersed a little bit. One group went off one way to protect a flank, and the others were kind of pointing their guns at these kind of scattering militia and whatnot, and again, a few gunfire back and forth. And then the grenadiers kind of came up behind them. The foot soldiers got reorganized, and they shot one victory volley. That was kind of a common place to do that. Once they were all done with an engagement, if they felt like they won, they would all kind of line up and shoot one more volley, so to speak, into the air. And then they marched on to Concord while they were also searching several places where it was reported that these stockpiles of munitions were. And these were rifles, bullets, and cannons and cannonballs and things. And the militia people were hiding some of this stuff. They put a bunch of stuff in the river, some barrels of things in the river and whatnot, and later they fished those things back out. But they did find some cannons and things, and so they spiked the cannons, and they broke the trunnions off so they couldn't be used. Okay. And did some things. But they moved on to Concord, where the militia was a little bit more prepared. Now, at Concord, they were in the hills, and they were kind of around, and they got to Concord. There were two bridges into that town.
Now, we're still not on the same day.
We're still on the same day.
We're still on the same day.
So this was about an hour or so later. They made it to Concord, and again, a little skirmish breaks out there. They're again still searching for these munitions and whatnot. And then eventually the British realize that now they're starting to get outnumbered. They only had about 100 guys with them, and the militia are numbering about 200. Now, the militia aren't as well organized, but they realize, British realize that they're getting kind of outnumbered. This is getting a little beyond them. So they turn around and start to march back towards Boston, which they start to harass them. The militia does by hiding behind little trees and rocks and things and kind of just hitting them every so often with kind of some pot shots at them as they work their way back, and starts kind of a little bit of a panic. And so these guys start to go from quick time to double time to run time. And that fight back towards Boston is really what takes a number of casualties on the British side.
That's really what establishes the flashpoint that day.
Mm-hmm.
Is the flashpoint for what ends up living out the next, how many years, the American Revolution?
It was to 1789, technically. So April 19th, 1775, almost a year before we've signed our Declaration of Independence, we're in conflict with our government at the time.
Wow. Well, I say it with tongue in cheek, but it's time for another revolution. Folks, it's Rosie on the House here with Dr. David Dean, Assistant Professor of History at Grand Canyon University, having a little fun with the tax code.